When people found it all, oh god, 2019, same year as me though.
Yeah,
I was in 2019. But I was there 2 years before. Yep.
Yeah.
After that, we'll be in bed.
Is that the usual bedtime?
Or is that being a thing?
Oh, that's your, I mean, that's your, from my mind, my wife, my sister.
Well, like, I would think that this is very good. Oh, no, yeah, I will. Trust me. This is my last big, this is my last thing. And I can give her some
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
I got one up here. We're all good. Good evening. Can everyone hear me okay? Perfect. Wonderful. I'm Dr. James Brooks, Melanie Trent, the Shutter Library Director here at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this evening lecture. We wish to acknowledge the generosity of former trustee Anne Worrell, who endowed this lecture series in honor of our former president and CEO, Dr. Charles Bryan. Of course, we meet this evening during Black History Month, a month in which we celebrate achievements by African Americans, calling attention to their pivotal role in American history and society to this day. While we contemplate their triumphs and endurance this month, we must also understand that there are a few aspects of our collective history that can be studied without recognizing the contributions and roles of Black Americans, and that appreciation of this fact cannot be confined to a single month on a calendar. Before we get started with tonight's program, I just want to let you know about one upcoming event. So on Tuesday, 13th of February, tune in for our next edition of Movie Myth Busting, for which the VMHC will be hosting a discussion of the 2017 film Marshall, which tells the story of Thurgood Marshall, the crusading lawyer who would become the first Black American to serve as a Supreme Court justice. And just before we get started with tonight's program, can I please remind you to either switch your mobile phones to do not disturb or put them to silent, please. Tonight, Dr. Marvin Charles joins us to discuss racial reconciliation efforts in Richmond following the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Indeed, Richmond was a national leader in these efforts, with residents, business leaders, and public history organizations working to fix Richmond's economy and public history scene to overcome its past reputation and the realities of racial strife. And yet, this movement unintendedly opened past wounds, emphasizing racial gaps in wealth building, housing stability, and educational achievement. Here to talk to us about this subject tonight is Dr. Marvin Childs. He serves as an assistant professor of African American history at Old Dominion University and has published numerous articles, including in our own Virginia Magazine of History and Biography, that explored attempts to reform Jim Crow law in Richmond between 1930 and 1954. This article won the Rachel Award from our institution in 2021. Marvin has conducted research to support his work in our own archives, and indeed, he is considered a friend of the library and, of course, of the VMHC more broadly. Tonight's talk is drawn from his first and recently published book, The Struggle for Change, Race, and the Politics of Reconciliation in Modern Richmond. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Marvin Childs.
Hello. welcome. And again, thank you all for coming here to listen to me ramble for the next hour or so about a history that I did not know was as important as it was until after I wrote it. Right. And so the first thing I will say is that I will, one, give thanks to the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. They brought me in when I was a graduate student. They gave me a fellowship to help me do research that later on ended up being a part of this book. So I want to thank them. They have long been a helping hand and a platform for my work. Number two, I want to thank a few people who aren't here. One is my advisor, Dr. Robert A. Pratt. He's the professor of history at the University of Georgia. He oversaw this project from beginning to end. I also want to thank Brian Daugherty, who's a professor of history at VCU. And lastly, Julian Maxwell Hayter, who's a professor at the University of Richmond. These men came in, saw the value in this project, and took me in when I was just a graduate student and kind of showed me the ropes on how to get this thing from shop floor all the way to product line. And so just now that I got that out the way, I will now talk about the history of Richmond, right? When most people think about the history of Richmond, they don't typically think about good things, right? The history of Richmond is often riddled with stories of racism, right? And for good reason. When people think of Richmond history, they think about slavery. They think about Jim Crow. And when I was off in college and I began to take the historical profession seriously and I began to research the history of Richmond, one, because it's my hometown and it's something that I wanted to know more about. I came to realize that Richmond's current existence, right, it's the actual way in which it handled its race relations was out of step with the way that scholars wrote about it. And so I spent, I would say, between 2014, 2015, between that and 2020, really digging into the archives, scouring the landscape, really going into every institution that I could here, the Valentine Museum, BCU, and other institutions throughout this town to kind of get as much history as I could, information as I could to see, is Richmond's reputation with being one of the most racist cities in America in step with its reality? And I found out that, in fact, it's not. Okay. However, many of the efforts that are detailed in my book that I will talk about tonight did, in fact, really help to reinforce many of the racial inequities that we still see today in modern Richmond. And I'll explain exactly how that happened. And again, it was the unintended consequence of good efforts that took place after the 1960s. And so in part one of my book, for those who bought it, buy it. Okay. So in part one of the book, I talk a lot about why Richmonders, okay, everyday people, people in City Hall, people on Main Street, people in the West End, people in Churchill, you name it. Why did they want or need to, in many ways, they felt compelled to engage in racial reconciliation? Why? Okay. Well, the 1960s did a number on this place. Okay. I don't know how many of y'all remember 1960s Richmond? I don't. I wasn't here. But I read up on it, and from what I read, things weren't that great, right? Prior to the 1960s, Richmond, like many Southern cities, was a Jim Crow town, right? It was a place where whites and blacks were separate by law and custom, and by and large, people really didn't question that, right? If you lived in a black neighborhood, or you lived in a white neighborhood, or you went to a white school, you went to a black school, people just kind of accepted that's just the way that life was. Well, the 1960s fundamentally wrecked that. Okay. By the 1960s, people had televisions in their homes, right? People were consuming national media at a scale that they weren't consuming at the rate higher than they were consuming local media. And all throughout the country, people started to watch and witness the civil rights movement, as in protests, as in sit-ins, as in marches, the likes, begin to make its way through the South, all the way through the South. Okay. And then you had a little bit of that activity here in Richmond as well, which I'm pretty sure some of you know about. However, the Black leadership here in Richmond, and watching the civil rights movement take place elsewhere, they wanted to bring that here to Richmond. And when I say civil rights movement, I mean they wanted to end Jim Crow segregation. They wanted to make Richmond into a city where race was no longer a barrier to social progress. And so in the 1960s, Black leaders, at the behest mainly of Henry LeVander Marsh II, who longtime mayor here, served also in the state house. And I believe he is currently still with us, although he's in advanced age. Henry Marsh and those who worked with him tried their best to infiltrate City Hall. That was their big thing in the 60s. Infiltrate City Hall, as in gain elected office. Okay, gain elected office. And why did they want to gain elected office? Well, they wanted to seize control of the city council and use that legislative branch of government to make newer laws to effectively get rid of racial segregation from the city. That's what they wanted to do. That's what he and others like him wanted to do. However, he was opposed, right? Just like civil rights activists throughout the rest of the country, he was opposed. And he was primarily opposed by white business leaders who were also political leaders. Back then, they were effectively the same people. Okay, so the people who ran Main Street also ran City Hall. The people who ran Main Street also ran Broad Street, right? Practically the same people. And they didn't necessarily like that, okay? For reasons I'm pretty sure you guys can understand. And so as Henry Marsh and those like him began to make a play to control the city council, white business leaders and white political leaders, they began to enact what was already a long-range plan to turn the Richmond suburbs, we're talking Henrico County and Chesterfield County, into one large metropolitan area, one large jurisdiction. And again, this had been something they had tried for years before, but by the time you get to the 60s, there's no bigger need for it than now. Main reason why is because if they added the suburbs into Richmond's jurisdiction, it makes it all one city. You have an overwhelming white majority who will continue to vote for white city councilmen in perpetuity. Right. That was the idea, is that you're able to prevent racial changes through consolidating the suburbs into the city. OK, simple as that. However, well, the courts had something to say about that, right? The federal courts, it at first kind of ignored it, but eventually the federal courts would step in. But for a small time, we're talking January 1st, 1970s, when an annexation did take place, Richmond was able to purchase some land southwest of the city in what was formerly Chesterfield County, and now is to this day part of Richmond. And in doing so, they added around 50,000 white middle-class people back to the city as residents, people who had, you know, years before, in some cases months before, picked up and fled the city. Well, now they're roped back in into being city residents. Well, less than a month later, in fact, Richmond undergoes a civil rights lawsuit. Wasn't the first, wouldn't be the last. But this lawsuit was one that was aimed at city schools for maintaining segregation, and in the process, the Richmond School Board not only complied with the courts, they worked with the courts to assure that city schools would get rid of segregation and they would begin to integrate schools across the city. But the people who would be most tasked with integrating those schools, as in white students going to previously all Black schools, will be those in the recently annexed side of Richmond. Okay, the 50,000 or so white, or 40, it was around 40, between 45 and 47,000. When I say 50, it's a round number, but around 50,000 middle class whites who were just recently added into the city against their free will, right? And so all throughout the early 1970s, we're talking from 1970 to 1975, Richmond's racial issues are platformed at a national level. They're in national newspapers. We're talking the Washington Post, the New York Times, you name it. And it is because the city itself is constantly in and out of court over issues of the annexation, over issues with schools. And it gets really, really nasty. In fact, much of the anti-busing boycotts or anti-busing protests that you see in modern America today, like we're talking videos and pictures you see online, a lot of that came out of Richmond. It came out of the Richmond area. And Richmond's what people call then subtle racism really bubbled to the surface. And so by the time you get to 1975, 76, 77, Richmond as a city began to get a better handle on these legal issues. For one, the federal courts began to back off. The city of Richmond did get to keep the land that it annexed in 1970. However, the Richmond area was effectively divided by race in ways that it wasn't even done during Jim Crow. While segregation was legally finished by the time you get to the late 70s, early 80s, the Richmond area was a chocolate city. It was defined by a chocolate city and a vanilla suburb. In the interior of Richmond, you had the area's poorest and blackest people. And on the outskirts, we're talking Chesterfield and Henrico, the area's whitest and wealthiest. And this is what defined Richmond, not just internally, but to the rest of the country. Okay. And so that's part one of the book. But you better still read it, even though I gave you the cliff notes. Okay. All right. Part two of the book, I talk a little bit about the first ever racial reconciliation measure undertaken by city residents and why they chose to do it. Okay. And so you have a majority black city surrounded by majority white suburban areas. And the only time that the two interact primarily is when the middle class whites go into the salt mines, as I like to call it. They go into Richmond, work their job, take their income and take it back out to the suburbs, go live. OK, this is a normal function of Richmond life for most of my life. And it was especially true back then. However, things happening at the national level forced Richmond to have to change the way that it did business. And those things mainly would be the election of Jimmy Carter and the election of Ronald Reagan and the nation's economy shifting heavily by the time you get to the late 70s and early 80s. What's happening nationally? America's deindustrializing. OK, prior to the 60s and 70s. Most middle class people in America were blue collar middle class. They worked in a factory, they worked along a port, and they were able to make a decent, what we would now consider middle class salary and live a middle class life. That's slowly dissipating by the time you get to the 70s and 80s. Manufacturing is getting offshore to Latin America and later Asia is practically what's been happening for years at this point. But it starts then, okay? And so in the process, there's a new wave of middle-class jobs hitting American cities. And that new wave of jobs is in the bureaucratic bureaucratic managerial and administrative middle-class corporate headquartering, right? So effectively downtown offices for major corporations in which you have hundreds of people basically pushing paper, right? We're still kind of in this economic phase today, although AI is doing a number on it. And if you've lost your job because of AI, I'm sorry, but this is where that phase of American economic history was. Most Americans who were middle-class were now entering into a white-collar environment. And so cities like Richmond were in danger, right? Richmond was a manufacturing city. That's what it had been for a long time, even during the days of slavery. And so Richmond leadership, we're talking elected leadership who are now majority black by the late 1970s. They are in danger of the city going flat broke, okay? Manufacturing firms are leaving, and what are they gonna replace it with? Same thing with those on Main Street who once controlled City Hall, now they don't control City Hall. They still control Main Street. And in many cases, they themselves wanted to see Richmond have a economic renaissance, but they knew, and I say they as in those on Main Street, many of the attorneys, people ran brokerage houses, and people in City Hall, black elected officials, they knew that the only way that they were going to help to revive Richmond economically and make it viable in the late 20th and early 21st century amidst this economic wave was that they had to come together. Okay, they had to come together. City Hall and Main Street could not work separate or parallel to each other. They had to work side by side with each other. And that's when you get the first phase of racial reconciliation. And this begins really with two projects. There were other projects as well. I only talked about two in the book, but you had Project One and the Sixth Street Marketplace. And both of these projects were done with black city leaders, black elected city leaders, working with white business leaders along Main Street to build new business infrastructure in downtown, to recruit industry to come in, right? White collar middle class jobs, and also to build a downtown mall. That's what the 6th Street Marketplace was. A downtown mall, a place where white people from the suburbs, I mean, they're explicitly saying this, white people from the suburbs would come in, or middle class people from the suburbs would come in, spend their money in hopes that they might return to be residents again, bring their tax money back to the city. And both of these plans, and again, these were not done in a way that wasn't controversial. This was not easy, a smooth sailing, as the book will detail. There's a lot of conflict and controversy. However, this laid the foundation for racial reconciliation, because two historic enemies, black leaders and white leaders in Richmond, had come together for a common goal and a common task. And that task was to rebuild Richmond and rebuild its race relations, primarily by fixing the economy. But rebuilding race relations was at the forefront of their goal and their efforts. In fact, they prioritized making sure that there was an equal number of black leadership and white leadership in these plans, crafting these plans, shaping these plans. One such example would be the 6th Street Marketplace's Affirmative Action Pact, right? It was called Minority something. It's in the book. And so this affirmative action, it's effectively affirmative action. This affirmative action plan was to assure that the 6th Street Marketplace had an equal number of black vendors and white vendors, and even vendors or firms that rented space that were white owned, they would have to have as close to equal number of black and white people working for them. And if they didn't, they had to justify why, right? And then also there was a certain amount of rental space segmented off for black businesses. You can go down the list. It was like a big platform plan that they implemented into these urban revitalization projects in the 80s. And the goal was to, again, show Richmond and show the world that the only way that the city was going to improve itself, improve its image, improve its function, was to fix its race relations. And it began with black leaders and white leaders immediately after the nastiest time in city history, when racial turmoil made its way to the national realm through newspapers, through television, through the busing drama, the whole nine. Okay, so that's part two. Again, cliff notes, but still read that book. All right. So that's part two of the book, and part three, I deal with the people basically coming back and telling leadership in Richmond that they themselves don't own racial reconciliation. So a huge part of these elite reconciliation measures, a huge part of them failing was that the people themselves did not get on board. Okay, Richmond residents, we're talking white Richmonders, black Richmonders, white folks in the suburbs, and even black people who would go out to the suburbs. They didn't buy into this stuff. They felt that the city was spending more money, as in city leaders, as in elected officials and business people, were spending more money on infrastructure instead of spending money on people and improving people's lives. And so part three of the book details how everyday people in Richmond began to, in essence, take reconciliation back from the hands of those in leadership. One of the groups that was prominent in this was the Richmond Urban Institute, a group that had practically gone missing from the historical record, to my horn until I wrote about them. But Richmond Urban Institute, which was a group of professors at BCU and black grassroots organizations, and they began to refocus reconciliation on improving the lives of the city's lowliest people. Okay, the people who city government simply either could not afford to care for, or city government chose not to care for, the people that business leaders either could not focus on or chose not to focus on. And so the Richmond Urban Institute focused on things like ending redlining, making sure that local banks invested in working class neighborhoods, both black and white, making sure that poor black people in the city could get a mortgage, could get a capital improvement loan. They also worked with the GRTC to make sure that all parts of the city had equal busing access to downtown, where many people at the time worked. They, as in the Richmond Urban Institute, went into the poorest, blackest areas of Richmond and created makeshift job care or child care services. So many of the people who worked, who lived down there, could afford to work longer and provide for their families and not have to worry about where their children were going. They were doing great work. And again, this Richmond Urban Institute was like the efforts done by business leaders, done equally between blacks and whites. Both black and white people occupied the institute and ran the institute on an equitable scale. And again, doing this to promote reconciliation through improving the lives of everyday people in Richmond. And so those are just a few things that they did in the 1980s. And in the late 1980s, they really petered out of existence by 1990. But with the Richmond Urban Institute effectively going away by 1990, their reconciliation model, that of focusing more on people instead of on institutions and the economy, that doesn't go away. That doesn't go away. So you have one neighborhood group that sprang up by the early 90s. Hope in the Cities. This is a group that came out of the Caroline neighborhood, not too far away from here. Anybody know what Caroline is? Caroline neighborhood. Okay. Yeah. I don't know if some of y'all live in the Caroline. Some of y'all may be familiar with this group. But this group came out of the Caroline neighborhood. Robert and Susan Corcoran, who longtime residents in that area, they just recently moved like a few years ago. They helped me a lot with getting the information for this book. That group came about really in the early 1990s with an agenda to put Black and white Richmonders, and I'm talking everyday people, into everyday conversation about city affairs and city life. And they were very successful with this. And they would do it through potlucks, right? So like neighborhood groups coming together and sharing food and just talking. I mean, just normal everyday stuff we wouldn't think about. And so one of the things that they did spur was local institutions like this one, the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, then the Virginia Historical Society. I still call it the VHS. I don't care what they say. So the VHS, the Valentine Museum. What are some of the other institutions that are eluding me right now? The Virginia Fine Arts Museum, right next door to us. Other institutions, they compelled those institutions to begin to talk about race in Richmond like people on the ground were talking about race. See, when Hope in the Cities and other neighborhood groups in the 90s were getting together and talking about Richmond's issues, they were talking about race. They were talking about how is it that the races are still living separate lives? How is it that there's still racial animosity, in spite of the fact that Richmond helped produce Virginia's first Black governor? I think to this day, only Black governor, right? And so local institutions took that seriously, right? They took that seriously that everyday people in Richmond were getting together, Blacks and whites. And again, these were not very powerful people getting together and trying to better understand each other and better understand their racial history. So they began to produce that within their institutions. Like they begin to produce exhibits about slavery, exhibits about Jim Crow. They also begin to employ groups to come in and put on exhibits about the city's history with slavery. The Museum of the Confederacy, which I believe now is shuttered, right? That institution brought in Black historical groups as well to come in and talk about the history of Jim Crow, the history of slavery. And it later led to obviously some hallmarks or some accomplishments, like the putting up of Arthur Ashe on Miami Avenue, which many people nationally thought was a spontaneous moment. No, it was actually the product of long-held discussions within Richmond about its race relations and how talking about its history could actually produce positive outcomes. You have the American Civil War Museum. Sorry, I was thinking Tredegar. I know it's not Tredegar anymore, but the American Civil War Museum, which came about because Richmonders wanted an institution that could better interpret and talk about its Civil War history, its lost cause history. And so local neighborhood groups spurred institutions like this one and others just like it to begin to re-examine Richmond's history with race and put it on and put it out there to the public in a way in which they could see that Richmonders were not completely blinded or completely hampered by the racism that had long separated them. That racism being Jim Crow and slavery. And so, but with that, with those efforts taking place, Richmond has had to deal with the unintended consequences of all that positive good going on, okay? So as Richmond has improved its race relations throughout the late 1980s, 1990s, going into the 2000s and 2010s, I'm pretty sure y'all have noticed a lot of people started moving here, right? A lot of people, a lot of businesses moved here. And a lot of it is because Richmond's reputation has improved. I can tell y'all, I've looked into the past, okay? Richmond had a hard time for a long time getting industry to come in primarily because of the perception that it was a very racist city. If you run a corporate headquarters, or if you run a corporation, you want to bring a headquarters or a branch here to Richmond, for a long time, people wouldn't do it because they were afraid. If we hire some black dude out of Cleveland, Ohio, will he be able to find a decent house and make a life here in Richmond? And for a long time, people believed that wasn't the case. Well, that was no longer the case by the 2010s, okay? And so Richmond has received a massive influx of people over the last decade or so. And again, it's not these people's fault, but as they have come in, along with businesses that have brought them here, Black Richmonders have actually suffered from this. One of the things they've suffered is the housing crisis. As you guys may know, housing costs have gone up. Okay, my wife pregnant, and we about to buy a house, and the prices done went up. I'm gonna tell you that right now. In case y'all don't haven't noticed, for people who haven't bought a home in a while, and a lot of that has to do with, again, the massive influx of people coming into Richmond because of its reputation improving. And so, but if you're the poorest and blackest city residents, securing stable housing has actually become pretty much impossible at this point. Rents are gone up out of control, and it's very, very difficult for them to maintain stable housing through the rental market. And even let's go with ownership, okay? Because this is something else. And VCU, I thank them, and I forgot the department that has done it, but they've done great studies on this. Is that you have black residents who purchase homes back in the 80s and 90s, right? And their homes are paid off. However, if taxes go up, they can be taxed out of their house effectively, right? And then they're pushed out of neighborhoods that they were trapped in economically for years before. And that's been a huge problem, right? So the issues with black access to affordable housing has actually gotten worse. Also, the jobs that have come in the 2010s, most of these jobs are in the knowledge-based economy, okay? Meaning you got to have a college degree, or you have to have something or skill sets equivalent to that in order to get in and compete for those jobs that's going to afford you a middle-class life. Richmond's economy is almost exclusively that now. Well, the majority of black people who grew up in Richmond are not going to go off to get those knowledge-based skills. And so whereas, let's say 30 years ago, a middle class life was only an application away at Philip Morris, right? Was only an application away at Breyer's Ice Cream Factory. That's no longer the case, right? If you want to go work for insert name of downtown company, right, you need to have a knowledge-based skill set. And many black Richmonders simply do not have that. And the place that you get that knowledge-based skill set, schools. Right. And by and large, black Richmonders are trapped in a school system that can neither afford to, or in some cases even have the will or desire to actually give them that skill set to compete in the 21st century economy. And so as Richmond has improved its race relations, Richmonders have gone out of their way to fix racial division and racism in the city. Unintendedly, there are some areas where the city has actually doubled down, if not tripled down, on racial inequity. And so I will leave you guys with this. And that is that Richmonders were really at the forefront. And I didn't say it before, but I'll say it now. They were at the forefront of American cities actively and going out of their way to fix race relations through economy and public image. They were doing it when not even Atlanta cared to do it, when not even Charlotte cared to do it, not even when DC cared to do it. And they did it, and they did it effectively, and they did it very well. So well that other cities began to copy what Richmond was doing. If you need to know about that, read the book, okay? that was Richmond's contribution to racial reconciliation in the 20th century. I dare to say that if Richmonders want to continue that legacy, they have to take it further into the 21st century by trying to really create a competitive environment where being born black in Richmond statistically doesn't mean that you're probably gonna end up working a job that's not gonna afford you the ability to own a home, or create a middle class life for you and your family. So thank you. Questions?
I'm going to ask you about a segment of society you didn't mention, maybe because they didn't have a role.
I'm listening.
I'm referring to the most segregated hour in the week.
Church.
What was the role of churches, both black and white,
Yeah, no, thank you for that. So in my book, I do mention the ministers that crossed the racial line to actually try to help improve race relations. Reverend Benjamin Campbell, who's, you know, everyone around town knows him, and for good reason. And so he was one. Sylvester Turner is another pastor. He's a Black pastor in the East End. He's done well to cross the racial barrier to go and work in racial reconciliation groups to try to improve race relations. Pastors themselves were very active in these groups. I want to be very, very clear about that. And also the church that comes to mind, St. Paul. I don't know if any of y'all are members there, the one that's downtown. There you go. Yes. St. Paul. I mean, if you want to talk about a religious institution that has prioritized racial reconciliation over the last 30, 40, 50 years, it's them. And so I've been, he's got a thumbs up over there. Okay. And no, it's true. And so religious institutions have been vital in this process. I talk a little bit about them. I don't talk too much about them in the book, simply because there were so many other institutions that were involved. And so I talk about mainly the religious actors from those churches going out and working with other groups. But no, you're right. Churches played a very important role.
I think truth telling is a very important part of getting past the racial divide.
Yes.
Do you think that the rumored Museum of American Slavery that mm-hmm. may be in Chaco Bottom mm-hmm. will help Richmond move forward in the 21st century?
Why you do that to me, man? Why you put me on the spot like that? So I will say this. I'm a proponent always of more history, not less, right? Telling more about the past, not less. And so I would say if I applied that as a general rule, I think it will do great. I will say this. We do live in a world now where people are, and I'm not picking on any one person or group of people. People are afraid to interact with the past in a way because they're afraid of what they might see, or they're afraid of what the conclusions people might draw from it, right? And I'm not going to lie. That was one of the things that I had to deal with writing this book. This book and the UVA Press, the representative from UVA Press is in the back, will tell you, you know, me writing this book was not something that sounded like other books about this same topic. There have been other books about the modern South, and those books, and I would say cities like Atlanta, Charlotte, New Orleans, you can go down the list. And those books were just doom and gloom, right? All day long, right? Oh my God, nothing has changed because people are just irredeemably racist. And that was not the story, one, that I care to tell. But even when the sources confronted me, it was even more proof that, I mean, I think I would be doing the past a disservice by just discounting all of the great efforts that people have made to try to improve race relations. And actually, there are tangible evidence for this and results for this. There was a time when a person like me would not be accepted into an institution like this. Well, I am now, right? So clearly something has changed. And to not write about it and talk about it, I think is crazy. So back to your original question. Fundamentally, I have no issue with any institution that's promoting the study of history in any way. I don't.
Being a Virginian, I really enjoyed the history of the matter.
Yes.
And especially since I lived most of it when having arrived in Richmond in 68. So uh-huh. I saw a lot of that. But I'm more interested in going forward, and I was hoping that we would talk more about that because I have a concern.
I'm listening.
I think we have hit a stumbling block, and I think mm-hmm. I noticed that Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. seems to be maybe a stopping, and we're going back a little bit. And I'm saying that from talking to both my white friends and my Black friends at both. Mm-hmm. Feel. I mean, on the one hand, Blacks seem to have some resentment uh-huh. because of that, and the whites, I think, have resentment too. Because I'll give an example, you know, just speaking for myself, we had the taking down the monuments.
Yes,
was a very emotional thing uh-huh. that could have been done correctly.
Right.
There was a method. If we had had a vote on it, uh-huh. I think that. It would have carried. Then nobody could complain because it was the people speaking. Uh-huh. But instead, we had a mayor, and I'm going to editorialize, who did not have the courage to stand up. You know, he let the riots, and I'll call them riots, the Black Lives Matter riots. Mm-hmm. He was scared, mm-hmm. and he would not carry out his duties. All he had to do was say, okay, we're going to put it on the ballot, mm-hmm. and job done, solution.
Okay. So no. I mean, you do raise a great concern. Thank you for that. And the concern you do raise is, what do we do going forward, given that we have the information that we have, right? And so, I mean, I don't know if any of you all have seen the documentary about taking down the monuments. And so I was in it right a while ago. That was back when I wasn't myself pregnant. Right. And so, back when my head was fully clean, right now, I got a little, bandage on it. But we talked about a lot of things in that film, and I thought it was very well done. However, I will say this, and this is to directly address what you're referring to. I don't think anyone, whether you agree with, say, taking down the monuments or keeping them up, likes the weaponization of history against opponents. I hope that makes sense. I don't think anyone likes that. That's a really, really nasty thing. And it has consistently happened over the last 20, 30 years, more consistently now than it has in the past. And so I would say going forward, I do think that historians, people like myself, we have an ethical duty. If we're going to write about the past, the recent past, we need to make sure that we're doing that in a way that what we're doing right now, engaging the public about it. Because if you do that, I think it tends to moderate some of the worst results of that. That could be like, say, when the mayor took down the statues against, I think it was against the court order, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. And there are a lot of people in town that said, hey, like you said, go through the process, go through the democratic process. But that didn't happen. And I think the result of it not happening does generate resentment for that process. And so, yeah, I'm with you. Since we know about the recent past, and not just my story, but other stories, people who say disagree with me about the nature of race relations, bring it to the public, talk about it with the public. And if you do want to go back and address something like monuments, make sure the public is heavily involved, especially considering it is their city, right? You guys actually have to live here and have to live with the result of it. And so I hope that addresses your question and your concern, because I feel you. I do understand that. Yeah.
I want to thank you for your incredible talk, mm-hmm. spanning 30 minutes to cover a book that took you years.
Yeah, man, I'm a motor mouth, so I just started talking. Yeah, I ain't got no notes and nothing up here.
It's amazing what you've done.
Yeah.
In 1991, I remember walking into the old city hospital, uh-huh. and seeing colored over one water fountain, white over another, colored over a bathroom. I was coming here as a surgeon, and I couldn't believe that what has now become the most important city in transplantation and opening a field where black and white has no issue involving how organs get distributed.
Right.
Where the whole process that has made it equitable and fair, uh-huh. is in a city that seems to still not understand how it can make its legacy go away.
Right.
Where sharing and becoming the premier system for organ transplantation, uh-huh. is a way to learn how to go forward, uh-huh. from that time when that old city hospital in 1991 was still standing with the old Jim Crow South.
Right.
So I wonder, what have the higher institutions of learning, what have, mm-hmm. the medical societies, mm-hmm. done to take part in trying to change the way we go forward our history?
Yeah, no. So here locally, thank you for the question. I couldn't tell you what happens here locally. I do know that Edward Peoples, was a longtime professor here at VCU. I believe he was a doctor, not just a doctor professor, like an actual medical doctor. And he was, I could be wrong, but he was very much involved. And I got to speak with him before he died. He died back in, I want to say 2015. But he was heavily involved in doing things on his own end to do exactly what you're referring to, right? So to use medicine as a way to bridge racial divides and racial gaps. Institutionally, I couldn't speak to that. I do know here in Richmond, I do know that there are hospital systems across the country that have done that. Johns Hopkins University is very prominent with that. Emory University down in Atlanta is very good with that. Here in Richmond, I'm pretty sure it exists, but you know what? I've left room for someone else to write, which was one thing that my advisor down at the University of Georgia told me. He was like, when I proposed this project, I'm sorry, I'm rambling now, but you did this. This is your fault. So when I proposed this dissertation, I said, man, I want to write this big grand history of race reconciliation everywhere, yada, yada. And he's like, son, you will be here forever if you do that, right? You need to leave some room for other people to write. And then Julian Hayter at the University of Richmond, he said the same exact thing. He's like, don't be greedy, right? He's like, don't try to write everything. And so what I'm saying is, I hope that there's someone that is able to at least follow up somewhere down the line, even if it's 100 years from now, I don't care, that continues the history of racial reconciliation. Because I'm going to tell you, it wasn't a hot topic when I was going through grad school, but hopefully more people will write in that vein and address things like the medical community and their contribution.
Hi, I moved here this summer from Minneapolis, Minnesota, who is in the throes of their own issues and getting through things. So it's interesting. Just when you mentioned education is now has become a critical piece, there always has been. Why did education, was it forgotten? Why doesn't education come along with racial reconciliation? Because it's such a critical thing and it's missing in so many cities and so many areas.
Yeah, no, that is a great question. So I will refer back to the editor of my book, Nadine Zimmerly, who's in the back looking at me. And she mentioned this to me while writing a book a while ago. She said, I talked about schools in part one, and then I didn't talk about them until the end. And she asked effectively the same question, where the hell do schools go, right? Like, where the hell do schools go? And that is a great question. I will tell you here in Richmond, what happened is a sad story, is that after the busing issues exploded, and the Supreme Court came down, and they told Richmond that, as a city, you have to fix your own school problems. You can't force Chesterfield and Henrico to come in and become a unified school district. You can't, right? Like it's, and so that's what the court said. And so what happened after that was the court incentivized parents to flee, okay? Because now they knew that if they moved to Chesterfield and Henrico, they no longer had to deal with city schools in any capacity, whether it was racially, economically, from a competence standpoint, they didn't have to deal with it. I could just go to Henrico, Chesterfield, or if I love my beautiful home in the North Side, or I love my beautiful home in West End, I could just send them to private school. And so for a long time, there was a massive exit, or I would say exodus of talented of middle-class families and talented people from the school system. It wasn't completely bled dry, but damn near close. Okay. And so that had happened, and that undergirded a lot of this racial reconciliation that did take place in Richmond, because it just become custom. Even when I was coming up here in Richmond, it had become custom that if you moved to Richmond from elsewhere, or let's say you moved and lived in the city, by the time your wife got that baby bump, it's time for y'all to get the hell out of here and go to Henrico and Chesterfield, or start picking a private school. And people could think about two things at once in a way, to where it was like, I want to do the right thing racially, but I also want my kid to go to the best school possible, right? And that's how you get it to where a school system just was for years reeling. I mean, it was so bad to where when the city council would do these master plans, master plans would admit, oh yeah, this sector of Richmond is going to improve, this sector, but schools are just not predicted to improve. I mean, they were just flat out saying it. Like, yeah, there's no chance, because residents just would not send their kids there. And now they have done some things to try to fix that, right? So neighborhood schooling, which is allowed the wealthier neighborhoods in the city to keep their kids closer to their house. So it's like a magnet style schooling system that has been implemented. They ended busing in the 1980s, so no longer sending kids from one neighborhood to the next. But it hasn't helped, because once kids hit middle school or high school, parents are just picking them up and moving them, right? And so I do know there are definitely plans now in place to try to fix that, but I think that's going to be the hardest thing for Richmond to fix is schools, because although there have been progressive plans for the economy, progressive plans for housing, and I think Richmonders are on board with all of that, It's tough to knowingly send your child to a school that's not going to prepare them for the 21st century. That is a tough proposition for anyone, regardless of race. And so, yeah, I hate to be that person, but the answer is it was customary, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, unfortunately.
Who's working on that, and what are they doing?
Oh God, the superintendent's working on it. And I don't want to quote him wrong, but I do know the superintendent and the school board are working on a plan. They have been working on plans for the last couple of years, and so they tried to change the elementary school zones. That was one, and again, I'm butchering it, but that's one of the plans. But it's mainly the superintendent and the school board are working on plans to try to one. Keep people from fleeing the school district, and two, to make the school district attractive for people to sit to put their kids back in it. And so I don't know where the plans have gone. I mean, I stopped writing this book last year. but that was what was going. Are you telling me that city government is inefficient? Is that what you're telling me? You're telling me that tax funded institutions are not prompt and not getting things done in a timely manner? Ma'am, if that's what you're telling me, I'd have to believe you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah. But any other questions or concerns? Y'all got me here now, so might as well. No? Okay. Well, this is it.
And Marv is going to be in Commonwealth Hall after this talk to sign books and then answer any of the questions you might have. Thank you so much.